welcome to this edition of Biting Talk. Yes, Britain's liveliest food and drink podcast is back, as surely and reassuring as a freshly baked croissant, which, by the way, I would eat with marmalade and Marmite. Not mixed, but alternate mouthfuls from either end. Try it, it could change your life or your breakfasts, which is a good place to start. I'm William Sitwell, Telegraph restaurant critic and writer, and if you're new to Biting Talk, it's wonderful to have you. So sit back and enjoy a good half hour of conversation with me and some of the country's top culinary talent. This week, we're getting to grips with some meaty subjects, kicking off with a feisty conversation about venison with Mike Robinson. It all started when I spotted a picture circulating on social media of an M&S pack of Select Farms venison leg steaks. All very well, you might think, but this wasn't just M&S venison. This was New Zealand venison. Yup. At a time when the British countryside is being overrun and environmentally damaged by out-of-control herds of delicious, tasty deer, a supermarket is shipping in venison by the container load. I'm giving the floor on this subject to the man known as the Game Chef, Mike Robinson. M&S execs, steel yourselves. Then we touch on another subject of eternal controversy, Michelin. Should they really have dished out awards and deleted stars in a year when hospitality is on its knees? I know one man who can steer us on this. He's our good friend Joe Warwick, and he's now not just a food critic, he's a Michelin-starred waiter. Yup, his regular gaff solar won a star this week, which might have even cheered up old Joe. Stay tuned for that. Then I'm so happy to welcome a brilliant female chef onto the show, the wonderful Marianne Lum. She must be thanking her lucky stars she didn't sign up to run a restaurant last year and is back private chefing. She's also teamed up with Finish and Feast, providing, and I speak from experience, some of the best posh food boxes out there. And guess what? This is why I love it so much. There's very little washing up. Finally, Farhad Haidari has a cocktail inspired by the recent US presidential election. Or is it just an idea he got from looking in the mirror? Do not tune out before you hear that item. But first, it's a warm welcome to Biting Talk to chef and restaurateur Mike Robinson. Now, if there's one thing guaranteed to rile the nation's foodies, at least those who believe in buying British, it's a tweet mentioning M&S Select Farm selling New Zealand venison leg steaks. Now, it's kicked off a bit of a rumpus on social media, so I'm delighted to help me kick up even more of a fuss about this scandalous incident. I'm joined on Biting Talk by the man known as the Game Chef. It's Mike Robinson. Mike, welcome along.
Yeah, William, it's great to be here.
Now, listen, I know that you're passionate about game, and we can talk about that in due course. But here we are, and I want to discuss this. There's a bit of a, I don't know if the word is a pandemic, there's certainly an overspill, a lot of wild venison. There's a lot of deer because of the fact that restaurants are not ordering it, roaming the landscape. And here we are. Now, this is often a discussion people have about lamb, New Zealand lamb, but New Zealand venison leg steaks. When I say those very words to you, Mike, what are you thinking?
It makes me depressed, genuinely. I mean, I think it puts into focus the madness of the world at the moment. You know, we have some of the most phenomenal wild venison in the UK, in the world, in the UK. It eats the most delicious stuff. It lives in a lovely climate. All the deer species we have in Britain, you know, eat beautifully, and there's more of them than there have ever been since Roman times. In fact, we always say since Roman times. The bottom line is probably ever, because we have all these introduced species that are also flourishing that we didn't have pre-Ice Age or pre-Romans or whatever. So for me to be importing New Zealand farm venison when, you know, we produce a lot of very good farmed venison. Now, the whole farmed versus wild thing is a big issue because supermarkets tend to default to farmed because of the consistency of it. Everything is the same. You know, it's the old wonky carrot argument. They have to set up a notice now. You know, we have every single safeguard in place to allow with the Food Standards Agency inspection system for venison that we have to go through. We are rated effectively the same as an abattoir for wild deer. Therefore, why aren't the supermarkets buying wild venison? Why are they buying farm venison?
Yes, and also it must be true to say, I suppose, that a lot of the venison we get in supermarkets, it's not all wild. A lot of it, I mean, it lives in the wild areas, but you go up to the Highlands of Scotland and you see them. They are fenced in, even if it's quite a large field, and that's often perceived as a wild product.
Yeah, there are three distinct demarcations of classifications of deer in the UK, and it's easy to lay out. First, you have wild, i.e., the deer are live wild, fully wild. They are not interfered with. They eat what they want, often what we don't want them to eat, and that's part of the problem. But they're wild. Then you have park deer. Now, these are deer kept in an ornamental park. Take Woburn Abbey or, you know, whatever. Almost any English or British manor house, mansion, stately home with the suffix park in its title originally had a deer park attached to it. And at some point, that park has been left to go to rack and ruin. The fences have gone down and the generally fallow deer have escaped out into the wild and have now formed large wild ones. But we still have a lot of park herds. Now, park deer are great. You know, they live as wild. And for me, one of the best things about park deer, you are actually, you know, you can harvest them where they stand in the park where they live, which means you don't have to take them to an abattoir or put them under undue amounts of stress. Farmed deer are just that. They are farmed. That means that they are kept, you know, in enclosures. They are fed because they have to be fed. So they're fed usually very well, often organically, you know, concentrates, grain, whatever, grass, silage. But they have to be killed under abattoir conditions. So those are the three different classifications. What the effect on our environment is with wild deer. And so my passion is wild deer. I want to see wild deer managed. And we think that this year in the UK and last March, when March is one of the key months for culling female deer, which is how you bring down a population. Of course, all of us restaurateurs with my chef head on had to shut down in March. So the game dealers stopped buying the venison. Therefore, people stopped shooting it. This year, we get to November, the start of the female season for deer. Bingo, down we go. And we frankly haven't been open since. So the only deer that are being harvested or shot in the wild this year, the Forestry Commission is still shooting because they have to. They're very fierce on deer. They feel they need to protect their herds. So the forest, they're trees. So the Forestry Commission is still shooting. I don't know what they're doing with the venison, possibly giving it away. But game dealers are not buying venison in anywhere near the same amounts. My old friend down in Berkshire, Alan Hayward at Vickers Game, normally buys, he told me this 2 weeks ago, he normally buys 200 to 300 deer a week at this time of year, off wild deer. So he's buying 50 a week now, William. That's the point. He's buying 20 to 25%.
Yes. So getting back to the nub of the issue, we have not more than enough. But we have too many in the wild, which need to be culled for environmental reasons. What possible reason could, in your view, M&S in their Select Farms branding have to stock venison leg steaks on their menu and ship it from you know, over such a great distance? What possibly could they have in mind? Why do you think this is happening?
I think it's inflexibility. They've always done it. It's easy to have regularity of supply. One of the things about farm deer is you don't have to sit within the existing seasons. You know, a farm deer is a farmed animal, so you can harvest them when you need to harvest them effectively, whereas a deer that's wild has to be harvested within the legal seasons. So New Zealand, you know, they the other way around effectively. So when the English deer seasons are closed, they can buy New Zealand venison when it's at the peak of the New Zealand season.
Yes, which is what some of the arguments use for lamb, except that a lot of British lamb producers would say, actually, there's plenty of different seasons for lamb. What would your message be then to M&S? What, man up?
No,
be flexible?
You know what? Embrace the brand. Create a brand around wild, sustainable, helping the environment, super healthy, and use like us. We are very small, but As long as the people supplying it are fully Food Standards Agency inspected, you know, we have a at my deer processing facility, we have a government vet turns up every single week and it rigorously inspects every single carcass, and I pay for that privilege. And then they, and that gets stamped with my ECN, well, not ECN number anymore, GB number. And that allows me to sell to anybody perfectly legally with full documentation and history. So,
okay. So they need to think positively, as you say, embrace the idea, not be sort of frightened into it. But let's also take the other part of this problem, which is the general lack of interest in consuming deer. People are obsessed with beef, probably even more so than lamb and pork in this country. Why do you think people are frightened of venison, frightened of buying it, fearful of buying it, unless they're in a restaurant where possibly you trust the chef and you give it a go?
I think there's been a historic blight against its name based on the fact that traditionally, if you go back quite a long time, most of the venison we were consuming was red deer, and it was from probably Scotland. It was often quite a long time between harvesting and market, between hill and market, and could often be quite bloody, irony, strong and gamey. The type of venison the way we're harvesting deer now, from red deer in Scotland right the way through to our shandy drinking southern woodland venison like fallow and whatnot, which is mild, sweet, unbelievably delicious, means that the deer is never strong anymore. We're controlling temperatures from the minute it's shot to the minute it's in it to the consumer, and so our deer now is pale, delicious. It's probably less strong than lamb. It's certainly better for you in terms of there's no saturated fat and no cholesterol in it. It's easy to cook. There's a million instructional videos on the internet on how to cook it beautifully, some of which are mine. And, you know, you should. And also there's a lot of schemes now allowing you to go online and buy it with great confidence.
And possibly people also a little bit worried about killing Bambi. Just get our taste buds excited, Mike, because you are a game chef. A couple of cuts. How would you cook it and make it really sumptuous and, you know, get us drooling?
So the two quick cooking cuts that are really simple to cook and delicious. One is, I know, something you rather like, which are like long bone chops on the bone that you can grill. They're about 3/4 inch thick. You marinate them with some olive oil. Pale, pale pink in color. Season them generously with flakes of sea salt and pepper, and then smash them on a nice hot grill for sort of 90 seconds to 2 minutes on each side, and then brush them with a bit of garlic butter while they're cooking. Let them rest for 2 minutes and, you know, chow down. The other one is the pavé, which is the beautiful steak off the haunch of the deer, where you get off a fallow deer haunch, you'll get about 15 of these delightful steaks. So cool because it looks like a pavé of rump steak, the classic French cut of meat that's supposedly shaped like a cobblestone, you know, like a nice fat lump of meat. And again, that's seared in a pan for about a minute and a half in foaming butter with rosemary and garlic until it's lovely and golden. And then we put it in a nice low oven for 10 or 12 minutes at 100 degrees. Take it out, rest it, carve across the grain. It's pink all the way through. It's sweet, it's mild, and you can eat it knowing that you're not getting any of the health detriments that you might have from an overconsumption of beef. If you have high cholesterol, if you're vaguely overweight, or if you're a fitness freak who wants lots of pure protein with no nasties, it's the superfood of meats.
Okay, well, you've sold us there. Mike Robinson, it's been an absolute joy to speak to you. Thanks for putting us right on this. Let's hope that someone from M&S is listening and gives you a call and starts buddying up and embracing this subject with a lot of positivity and love. Mike, thank you for coming on Biting Talk.
Thanks, William.
Well, my next guest on Biting Talk is familiar to fans of this podcast because he and I have co-presented it. He's presented it himself, and he's back today as a guest to talk about Michelin, because it's a big week for those stars. Lots of chefs celebrating, a few grisly ones not celebrating, and quite a lot of controversy. But first of all, I must say welcome to Joe Warwick and congratulations, because Sola, where you've been a waiter during lockdown or when it's been able to open, has gained its first star. So you, in fact, are a Michelin-starred waiter. Welcome, Joe.
Yeah, I am indeed. I am indeed. I've pivoted to a part-time flambé artist. Yeah, I mean, I was working there part-time, so it was probably very little to do with me, but really nice to be part of the team and really pleased for the team. And I think that's the thing about this. I read your piece. What did they pay you a word for that, by the way? You're going to tell me.
Let's explain what piece this is, because people don't necessarily know every word that I write.
Okay, well, I read your piece sort of saying Michelin shouldn't have done this because it's all about consistency and blah, 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 blah. And I've got to admit, you know, every year, you know, Michelin, it's as regular as you know, going on about native asparagus season or, you know, the first grouse of the season. It's like moaning about Michelin. And usually I am part of that. You know, I still have problems with the guide. I particularly had problems with the way they did the presentation show, but that's a whole other thing. Your piece was basically saying they shouldn't have done it this year because of what's going on. And I think on the reverse of that, I think they should have done it precisely because of what's going on. Because if you watched it, you saw how much it meant to everyone. I know how much it's meant to all the guys at Solar. And I think, you know, although Michelin are very corporate and have their own agenda, I think it really G'd up a lot of people in the industry.
I understand that positivity and I completely get that. But the negativity, how can you justify deleting stars? So Nathan Outlaw, Jason Atherton, when these restaurants have not been open for a sufficient amount of time to surely demonstrate, that they deserve the deletion.
Were they not restaurants that had closed?
Nope, they weren't.
Okay, because Nathan Outlaw got a new star for one of his other restaurants. So that's strange. I don't know the details, to be honest, of the ones that have been deleted. You tell me.
Let me put another point to you. Okay, so there's a restaurant called Behind, which is in Sidworth Street in London. Behind was opened in 2020 for 20 days. So how can Michelin justify the granting of a star to a restaurant that's only been open for, you know, 3 weeks? How many times did they go? This seems to me to be a little odd. Not that I wish to take it away from Behind. Congratulations to them for winning the star. But the mechanics of that seem to me to be a little bit strange.
I mean, I've no idea how many times they went into Behind, if they went into a couple of times. I know personally, Masola, they went in at least twice. I waited on who I'm pretty sure was the inspector the second time. A colleague of mine waited on them the first time. So they're into us at least twice, possibly a third time. Their argument is that actually they had done all of the work on this. In the case of Behind, I don't know. Maybe they went in twice. Maybe they've been following the chef. I'm guessing with somewhere like that, that have got a star so quickly that the chef has got a previous CV that they've been following, that they know who he is and they're assured enough. You know, I think the other thing to look at, we're talking about that, but let's talk about the other big story about Michelin this year. Two female chefs. You know, one of them British-Irish, Claire Smith, and the other one, of course, Helen DeRose, you know, who's also got the restaurant, but getting 3 stars. We've gained 2 more 3-star restaurants run by women. I mean, that's a fantastic story as well. Every year, Michelin gets criticized for something, and I think I understand it. But what's the alternative? They don't do it. They park it. Everyone's depressed. I don't think it's done any harm. I don't think it's undermined, you know, Michelin's values. And I think it's done more good than harm. It's not perfect. Nothing in the world is perfect at the moment. But then I'd argue that the Michelin Guide isn't perfect any year, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, very well put, actually. I think people will understand that. So thanks, Joe, for that. Tell us a little bit more about Solar, because as I say, it won a star. You've been waiting occasionally at that establishment. The chef patron's Victor Garvey, who is a New Yorker. Although born in New York, moved to Barcelona when he was very young, started working in those sort of kitchens as a teenager. What's for someone who doesn't know about Solar, tell us about the food and tell us what Victor Garvey's doing there.
Well, he's calling it Californian. I think it's Californian in the sense that he moved and worked around a lot of places, staged at Noma, El Bulli, et cetera, and worked in various places and worked in California for a bit. And the sort of food he's doing, which I would say is modern French, I suppose, technically, with some Asian influences thrown in, is what he first came across in California. So he's calling it Californian. We've got an all-Californian wine list. Wine in California has come on so much in the last decade. We've got some fantastic small producers, low-intervention wines. Just delicious wines. They're not that big, jammy fullness that you used to get from Californian wine, like really, really, really good. Different grapes you wouldn't expect to find in California, Albarinas and things like that. And Cunoise, which was a grape I'd never heard of, is actually one of the grapes in the Chardonnay de Pape blend, which we've got as a single varietal. So really interesting wine list. And quite old-fashioned in terms of the service. So we do flambé. Now we flambé lobster. A lot of kind of table side. Quite kind of intricate. A lot of fun going on. And it's a little small restaurant. We're only kind of 20 covers. We like to play old jazz. You know.
Yeah, let me ask, have you managed, Joe, to prevent your hair from catching fire when you're flambéing the lobsters?
I have it in a tight bun, William. You'll be pleased to hear.
Because I must, for those people who don't know Joe intimately, he does have fantastic hair and there's lots of it. And basically, you, I suppose, single-handedly prop up part of the shampoo empire.
I do. That's another sideline of mine. But yeah, in a bun, you got it. If you got long hair, you got to have it tied up, whether you're a man or a woman in a restaurant, because you don't want hairs getting in someone's food.
Yeah, and when it's the restaurant's been operating, I do feel for staff in masks and so on. Yeah. It's quite constricting, to say the least. It's very hard to see people smiling. There's the eye contact, but I think particularly in hospitality. You know, when people, you know, great waiting staff are trained, and the mouth and the way they speak and the expression is so important. How have you got over that? What's the GM saying in the restaurant about how to cope with that?
When we first started doing the mask thing, I found it really hard. It's a little bit like, you know, like try running with a mask on. You know, you're running around, and there would be times where I'd literally go, right, I've got to go outside, because we're right in the middle of Soho there on Dean Street. I have to go outside and have a breather. I'm not a smoker anymore, so that's it. I went outside for air. It's really hard work, and it's really hard work, particularly when the restaurant gets busy and buzzy communicating with people, because you forget how much people understand you from reading your lips. So you've got to be careful. You've got to project. The other thing as well in the restaurant industry, you've got a lot of people who English isn't their first language and they're speaking with an accent, and then you add a mask to that. It makes it really, really hard for them. So it's a challenge, but you know, we've got through it. We got through that. We got through the silly curfew. You know, and that's the thing that I found really inspiring about being back at the coalface of the restaurant industry. A, I quite enjoy it. B, I'm actually, without sounding arrogant, quite good at it. And C, the way that we've just adapted. Every time they threw something else at it, we're like, okay, how are we going to deal with this? And that's what we did, you know? And so that's why it's particularly pleasing about the Michelin star. Very frustrating, of course, that we can't get customers in to see what we're about that have heard about us for the first time. But we've just started doing one of these at-home kits. We're working with restokit.co.uk. So we do a weekly menu with them if anyone would like to see what the food's about. Current menu's got scallop diplomat, which is scallop on the half shell with black truffle and lemon thyme crumb and baked in the shell. We've got A5 Wagyu Chateaubriand. You know, some really nice things. If you want to get a taste of what it's about, we're not a cheap restaurant. You know, we're a luxury restaurant. So that, for example, that menu is £85. That's including delivery nationwide.
A bargain.
Well, for a special occasion, yeah.
I think people are spending a fortune. Adam Handling, he sells his some of his Heim kits for £300 for dinners for two. But yeah. Look, Joe, you've given us a wonderful taster of Sola. Let's hope it opens back soon within our lives. 64 Dean Street there in Soho. Joe Warwick, it's been wonderful catching up with you. Thanks for coming on Biting Talk.
Lovely talking to you, William. Thanks a lot.
Well, my next guest has joined that huge and growing fleet of chefs across this country sending out boxed food to punters. And I have to say that I was actually on the very joyful receiving end of her vegan hamper at the weekend. It's a very warm welcome to Biting Talk to Marianne Lum. Marianne, welcome to the show.
Thanks, William. Thank you so much for having me. Great to catch up with you. It's been far too long.
Listen, your vegan menu is some of the nicest vegan food I've ever had. That's the first thing. There was this beautiful tomato consommé that just had a sort of delicate whisper of flavour as a little mousse-bouche palate cleanser. And then there was a plate of earthy beetroot. And then there was a bunch of artichokes with something and a rather good pudding. These things are really hard. And I imagine you're sort of probably feel you're putting your reputation on the line when you're trying to replicate your food and probably get others to do it and send it out around the country. But the one thing I would say is of all the box food I've had, it was the lightest and tastiest and the easiest to cook. And there were very few saucepans involved. So you made the washing up much easier.
I'm delighted to hear that. I mean, William, it's a massive leap of faith to kind of trust someone with your recipes and your kind of reputation. I mean, and what I will say, like, I spent last summer in Sardinia cooking mainly vegan and vegetarian food. And it's really hard because, you know, you normally rely on butter and cheese and cream for kind of easy flavors, but with vegan obviously you have to work really hard. I'm delighted you liked it, and I think the other thing is no one else wanted to do a vegan menu, and so someone said, will you do it, Mary? And I was like, of course I will. And in my career, when I've done jobs that other people didn't want to do, I've really reaped the benefits from it. So that's one learning there. But I'm really delighted you liked it. I mean, it's been quite tough for the team at Finish and Feast, because we wanted to make it as easy as possible for the customer so that you feel like you're having a night off, basically, and you can kind of let your hair down and put your heels on if you wear heels and, you know, lay the table and light the candles. So it was quite hard for the team to do, but I'm delighted. That's exactly what we wanted the client to feel that they had a kind of night off and they had a lovely time.
I think what's particularly interesting, and I've noticed this when I've done events with chefs, the chefs who seem to be best prepared and also are under less stress are those who aren't afraid to serve food, either slightly chilled or ambient. And a lot of the dishes that came out of that beautifully vacuum-packed bag didn't need cooking. And it's just a little bit of sauce that needed heating. And actually, that's one of the tricks of the trade, isn't it, for chefs who don't want to make their lives too difficult.
Oh, completely. I think there's a whole cookbook about that, William. That's another story. But, you know, I remember doing private chef jobs where I wanted to do hollandaises, I wanted to do souffles, and I wanted to do this, that and the other. And I wanted to do everything hot last minute. And it's a nightmare, especially when you're on your own and you're not doing anyone any favours, least of all the client, because you're looking really stressed. So, I mean, it's very Italian to have kind of room temperature dishes, but I completely agree. If you've got one hot course, then you're kind of laughing. I mean, I had my most fun, I think, with the main course, because it was in Provence last January, when I was cooking at the at Chateau Margui. We were setting up George Lucas's estate there, which was an amazing role that was cancelled, boo, because of COVID. And it's like, what do you cook in Provence in the winter? Because you're not in the mountains and it's not in the summer. Kind of, you know, olive oil and tomatoes. So it's kind of, it's really good for you as a chef because it really pushes you and makes you kind of create flavours where there wouldn't maybe normally be flavours.
Yes, because you can't hide if your ingredient is there raw and room temperature. You can't escape. You can't hide without a, you know, if there's a lashings of hot sauce or piles of gravy, you can sort of cover up ingredients, can't you?
exactly. I mean, I think that main course, I was quite scary about it because it does look a bit like a pile of brown. But I was delighted. I was delighted to see Nigella talks about in praise of brown food, and I'm hoping that salsa verde kind of remedied that a little bit. But I did also. What's so funny is when you're creating food, like all of the my normal suppliers aren't functioning properly at the moment. So I wanted to include some flowers and some cresses, but then no one's growing any because all the restaurants are closed. So that was another hurdle because of, you know, so we had to do something that would be deliverable as well.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that. Of course, those farmers who you know, aren't, the baby coriander is not required right now. Now, you and I have known each other for a long time. I first came across you when you were touting your knife skills. You had a wonderful period in your life where you ran Marianne, the small, perfectly formed restaurant on Chepstow Road in London. You don't have a restaurant now. You're back to your private chefing days that were part of your sort of the building blocks of your career. You must thank your lucky stars that you haven't had a restaurant in 2020/21.
Oh, William, I do. I just, the weird thing is that when I left it, when I closed it, it was the most awful situation. It was like cutting the umbilical cord on a kind of baby that I'd been nurturing. And it was a really difficult decision to make. And I felt like I was letting down loads of people. And then, like, who would have predicted that this happened? And obviously, I'm so grateful that I don't have the restaurant. But then, you know, it's a double-edged sword because I'm kind of mourning an industry. And say, when I read your incredible book, The Restaurant, that is amazing, by the way. And I didn't realize you would go quite so far back as Pompeii. It's fantastic. And it's just, wow, like, what can I say? I mean, what's it going to look like? I miss the restaurant. I miss going to restaurants like everyone does. And I miss my customers. I miss the
yes,
produce.
As a head chef, that buzz, being at the pass, you know, mopping up the plate and just making it perfect, that camaraderie, you don't get that with it as a private chef. You've just got pesky clients and possibly their annoying children.
No, you're quite right. And you kind of miss your kind of rock star status that you do get. And even when you're tired, there's that lovely feeling of the team, and you never know who's going to come into the restaurant. And there's always something going on. But I'm not going to lie, it is nice not having all of that responsibility. And especially with a small one like that, there is a lot of responsibility. There wasn't as much delegation as maybe I'd like to have done. And you know what, William, we've got planning permission in Leicestershire for chef's table and a cookery school. We got that last summer and we're kind of saving up for that. But in the same way, you know, is that ever going to happen? You know, what's the landscape going to look like? What do you think?
Oh, I think it will. Life has to get back to some form of normality, and people want to eat out and people will want venues. So I want to do events where we've moved, and I think you should as well. I think it'll happen. Now, people who are fans of yours know that from time to time you pop up on our telly. I spotted you over Christmas on a
running
kind of
around
MasterChef revisit. You put yourself through that hell. You didn't win, but there you go.
I didn't. I think I maybe came last, actually. Maybe.
there was only a winner and runners up.
Oh, my word. Well, you know what? It was such a joy to see Greg. I haven't seen Greg for like 10, 12 years, and he looks so well. And like Greg, he is just churning out the jokes kind of 24/7, like he just doesn't stop. He's brilliant.
So people who don't know him, he's a sort of cracker joke book, isn't he? Literally, you have to sort of duck if you want to avoid them.
No, exactly. But my word, I kind of, William, honestly, I'd forgotten what it was like. And I'd just come from the south of France and I was buzzing because we'd luckily got this brilliant gig in Antibes, and it was for these incredible clients where they lived in, you know, they live in Monaco and they just wanted to have a fun summer with their children and with their mates. So we did this, it was such a fun gig. And so we were doing tasting menu on a Saturday night with 10 matching wines that I could source, you know, no budget. And then the next day it would be roast beef, Yorkshire pudding, espresso martinis, and let's go to the clubs. You know, so I was buzzing from that, and I came into that kitchen and then I suddenly realised what I'd let myself in for.
Yes. Now, I can't let you escape without asking about Michelin, because, of course, this is the week that the awards were dished out. Do you think Michelin should have had a year off, or, you know, and refrained from deleting a star from Nathan Outlaw and Jason Atherton? What do you think? Go on, tell me, just amongst ourselves.
I think I completely agree that they gave Claire Smith the third star. Her food has made me cry on occasion when she was 10 all the way at Royal Hospital Road. You know, amazing. I completely agree. And I'm delighted that two women have got 3 stars, of course.
But how can you get stars when you've been shut all year? I mean, how often have these Michelin men been to these places?
But those two are, may I say, sure things, I'd say. I mean, they are, you know, they are Michelin all over and they're incredible chefs, and I'm delighted for them. Yeah, it does feel a bit mean, the other bits. It does, you know, and I really sympathize. Michelin can break your heart, you know, they really can. But the good thing about Michelin, there's always something to discuss about them, isn't there? They're very clever.
Well, that's why they're clever, you see, because they are they are PR They do PR for tyres, and here we are talking about them. Exactly. So, well,
indeed.
Marianne, it's been actually lovely catching up with you. The boxed food scheme is Finish and Feast. People can look for it and get your food and various of others who are participating. It's lovely to hear you again. All the best for 2021, and a big thank you for coming on Biting Talk.
And you, my darling, so nice to catch up, and hopefully see you soon.
Regular listeners, and I love every single one of you, will know that no show ends without dipping into the curious world of Farhad Haydari, who this week, I believe, is describing a cocktail that actually is a vision of himself when he looks at the mirror. Is this correct, Farhad?
The cocktail is the bald eagle, Mr. Sitwell.
There you go.
And it's an ode to the US presidential inauguration now being safely behind us, so I thought it'd be appropriate. So what we're going to dip is first our martini glass. We're going to reverse it into a salt bed, a bath of salt, and we're going to garnish the rim, Mr. Sitwell, with some salt. And then we're going to empty the following ingredients all into our shaker. First, 60 milliliters of tequila, then 22 milliliters of grapefruit juice, it should be pink, 15 milliliters of cranberry juice, it should be as fresh as it can be, 7.5 milliliters of lime juice, same amount of lemon juice, and same amount of pure cane sugar syrup. We're going to shake those with ice, fine strain them into our martini glass, and boom! That's your bald eagle, and that's an ode to the U.S. presidential election now being safely, as I said, behind us. It's a tremendous drink, and it has a lovely little sour side to it. Gives you a kick every time.
There he is, Farhad Haydari, the Biting Talk mixologist, soaring high, the bald eagle, and garnishing his rim. Thank you, Farhad. I hope we'll see you. I hope we'll hear from you next week. And every week, I mean, that I'm still alive, I hope that we'll do this.
Absolutely. And I, too, adore every one of you listeners as well.
Farhad Haydari, everybody. Thanks, Farhad. For a more settling drink, how about a bottle of soothing Ducali Salice Salentino, a fab Italian red, for $11.25 at williamshousewines.com. That's almost it for this week. My thanks to Farhad, to Mike Robinson, Joe Warwick and Marianne Lum. Now, while Biting Talk comes to you as a free podcast, it does, of course, cost money, time and creative energy to make. And if you like the show and want to help us keep making it, why not consider supporting us here? In return for a monthly contribution from just £3, you'll get exclusive access to cracking bonus features, including Biting Talk The Grill, in which I indulge in some quick-fire grilling of one of my weekly guests, with topics ranging from Last Supper choices and worst jobs in hospitality, right through to the thing everyone wants to know, what would they cook for Boris Johnson? The Grill is guaranteed to give you plenty to chew on. This week's food star on The Grill is Marianne Lum. There's more information at patreon.com/bitingtalk. But from me, William Sitwell, thank you very much for listening, and sleep tight in the knowledge that Biting Talk is a Frontier production.